60s. There's no denying it. It's simply who I am. Born in the middle 60s, and I can remember the changes that took place in the 60s. There are a lot of things that I didn't remember. I went through the entire Vietnam era barely aware of the fact that a war was being fought. The only thing that brought it to mind was the fact that my parents at one time had us wearing MIA and prisoner of war bracelets. You maybe remember wearing those things as well. We're going to be talking about the 60s, but not just the 60s, the impact of the 60s on the church with Dr. Larry Rast here in the first hour of Issues Etc. We are coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon. We're broadcasting live from the 2005 Symposia Series at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. I'm Todd Wilkin. You can join us via telephone as we talk here in the first hour about the 60s in American Christianity. In the second hour, covenant theology. I especially invite our Calvinist listeners to join us there. We'll be talking about that with Professor Richard Muller. And then in the third hour, we'll get a bit of a review of that controversial document that came out of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America this last week. Finally, they have issued a report on sexuality. We'll be hearing from someone within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America on that document in the third hour of Issues Etc. today. Again, you can join us 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, broadcasting live this Tuesday from the 2005 Symposia Series here on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And you'll probably be hearing some of the speakers behind me and the noise of the crowds. Please don't let it distract you from our subject here in the first hour of the program, the 60s and American Christianity. Our guest is a regular guest here on Issues Etc., Dr. Larry Rast. He's Associate Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary. And I'm happy to welcome him here in the back of the auditorium on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary. Larry, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be with you.
Now, I call myself a child of the 60s because I was born in 1964. If you don't mind telling me, when were you born and are you similarly a child of the 60s?
I too, am a child of the 60s. I was born in 1962, so I have you by a couple of years.
You remember more of the 60s than I do.
I do. After about the middle part of the decade, after 1965, I remember quite a bit, as a matter of fact. And, a couple of things that really stand out in my mind. You said you weren't aware of Vietnam being fought. It was part
Barely
and parcel.
Aware.
It was part and parcel of my existence. My dad actually taught at the Ohio State University, and we lived near to the campus. And I recall, as a very young boy, being present on campus when the riots at Kent State broke out.
Really?
And then the National Guard having to be called out on the Columbus campus in response to what happened up at Kent State in the Akron area. So it was a tough time and an interesting time to be a little boy with parents who were very much involved with the university scene.
Now, Christians are acutely aware in America today, and I'm thinking here primarily about evangelicals, but American Christians are acutely aware of the impact of the 60s, the sexual revolution, the civil rights movement, the movement in academia, Vatican II, all of those things that occurred during the 60s on the culture. They're aware of all of those things' impact on the culture. Do you think that Christians, American Christians today, are adequately aware and appreciate the impact of the 60s on the church today?
I think within the more conservative churches, we haven't really come to grips with just how profound the effects of the 60s have been in our lives, the way we think, the general culture, and how we have appropriated that culture to ourselves. So that's to say that while some of the more mainline denominations have been very aware of what was changing and embraced the change and, in fact, encouraged the changes that the 60s were bringing along, some of the other church bodies that were more hesitant to adopt uncritically the shifts in culture that were occurring have, in fact, over time appropriated a number of those attitudes and have been really in fundamental ways affected by what was happening.
Unaware of the fact that they've appropriated
these things? Yeah, kind of an uncritical appropriation of some of the more, maybe initially not as radical expressions of the 1960s, but as time has gone by, it's a little bit easier to take these things in without actually engaging them at a critical level.
Most people, when they think the 60s, they think bell-bottom jeans, hippies, Haight-Ashbury. They think of the civil rights movement, students marching, as you mentioned before. they think about the death of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr. We just celebrated his life yesterday as a country. Is that a big enough picture of the 60s? If you just kind of get the Life magazine version of it, what do we need to know about the changes in the way Americans and American Christians fought during the 60s?
That's a very good question. If you have the big picture events, the kind of snapshots that capture the decade, you've mentioned some very appropriate things there. These are, you know, when Bobby Kennedy was shot, I remember it. Mm-hmm. Even though I was 6 years old, I remember the news coming down that day of this happening. And so, you know, there was a place, there was a time that I can locate in that respect. But while those serve well to kind of give us a frame of reference, they don't actually get us to the heart of how thinking, basic thinking, was changing in a lot of ways, and how distrust of establishment, throwing off the yoke of any kind of tradition, moving away from any outside authority that might have a claim on us, and seeking to be to implement the revolution at every possible level, that is, being free to express ourselves in every possible forum. Well, that happens not only within the hippies out in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, but we also see it happening in the church.
Let's do, before we get into the 60s itself, do a bit of a review of what the state of religion, and in particular Christianity, was in the United States prior to the 60s, in the 40s, the 30s, 40s, and the 50s.
Yeah, that's good. Because events like what we saw transpire in the 60s don't come out of nowhere. They have a background, and in the case of the establishment, if you will, that so many reacted against, religion in America, and then later on Christianity more specifically, I'll turn to that. But religion in America was oftentimes simply summarized as Protestant, Catholic, Jew. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a book along those lines titled that, saying you could pretty much sum up everything religiously in America in one of those three categories. Either you were Protestant, and there was a Protestant empire people like to talk about. You were a Catholic, and that kind of took care of the Christian side of things. And then for the more exotic religions, if you will, there was Judaism. And beyond that, you didn't need much. That pretty well covered the points. Now, bound up in that is an assumption about Protestantism that seemed to be rather dominant in the first half of the 20th century, and that was, while there were important differences that would characterize oftentimes the practice of the various Protestant church bodies, when it came to basics, when it came down to fundamentals, more or less, there was a sufficient agreement across the board to be able to talk about something called Protestantism that really serve the purpose of characterizing what the church was all about. Now, true, there were those who weren't part of that. Fundamentalism had been largely marginalized after the Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925. By the 50s, new movement, evangelicalism, was beginning to pick up steam. Mm-hmm. Christianity Today, Carl F. H. Henry working, doing his theological work, Fuller Seminary, and especially Billy Graham.
Sometimes called neo-evangelicalism.
Neo-evangelicalism, yeah. Sure. And coming out of the, beginning to develop itself, establish its institutions, and get its feet on the ground. So, and holding something of an uncomfortable position over against the dominant mainline Protestantism. But nevertheless, Protestantism was there. And if you asked, it was often the case, if you would ask a person, well, what's your tradition? If you said Lutheran, they'd say, now that's Protestant, right? That kind of thing. And to be a Catholic meant you weren't Protestant.
So the fact that I grew up as a Lutheran, lifelong Lutheran, thinking of myself until I learned better as a Protestant, a generic American Protestant, is largely due to the mindset that prevailed prior to the 60s.
I think so. I think that's a fair way of putting it. And this idea that there is a thing that you can identify that is Protestantism stretches back into the 1800s, and it was seen as, well, what one historian, Martin Marty, has called the Righteous Empire, and some people have called the Protestant Empire. This is what American Christianity was supposed to be all about.
Okay, by 1968, I'm just going to use that as a date because most people do, the pot was boiling. The pot that we call the 60s was boiling. You tell us about the first little bubbles before 68, what was it that was going on? What was changing? What was starting that gives us this era we call the 60s?
Well, some of the things we've already talked about. With increasing, let me use a couple of technical terms first, and then we'll run off from there. What you see as a continuing reality over the course of the 20th century in America is a shift from us being a rural population to being an urban population. And urbanization continues apace. The cities grow, the population growth is enormous, and more of that population is located in the cities, and you end up with some really basic kind of changes that begin to occur in the structure of the way people live with one another. That is to say, the older central cities begin to collapse, folks flee to the suburbs. That's already happening in the 50s, certainly. The emergence of blighted areas within the cities and the like will really affect the churches in some basic ways. And our own Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, will be affected in very profound ways by that, as some of the older historic churches, more than 100 years old, will find themselves in transition circumstances and be very hard-pressed to come to terms with it. So basic life patterns begin to change in that respect. In addition, you have greater and greater ability for people to be on the move. Transportation, Americans have always been a very restless people, and they like to wander, they like to move. But with transportation systems, first the railroad and later on the automobile and then the airplane as well, the jet airplane, just makes movement easy. And so unique localities and unique geographies begin to break down. And there's a flattening out in a lot of ways of the American of American culture generally, and what people are experiencing in particular. And then finally, it's not too much to say that a little thing like mass media, a little thing, has a tremendous impact. Radio first earlier on, but then by the late 50s and into the 60s, television as well. There's much more commonality as people's begins to be influenced by a dominant media kind of culture all the more, and these things start to come together and the opportunities they provide, the linked with an increasing kind of freedom. The school system is changing. There are differences in how we expect our children to grow up. The time frame for how they're going to develop and what their possibilities are on down the road. College becomes an expectation. All of these things percolate together, and as they in the early 60s, as they're working together in a melting pot, in a mixing pot, things really begin to heat up. And finally, like you said, 1968, maybe you go back to the summer of love, 1967. Yeah. We can always quibble about these things, the riots in 1965, but whatever the case may be, wherever you put the date, the fact is that there are basic cultural shifts that simply explode onto the scene and change our existence as a nation in fundamental ways.
Let's talk about each one of those, and with each answer, if you would, Larry, relate it to how it has now affected the church today. We're talking with Dr. Larry Rast, Associate Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where we're broadcasting live from the 2005 Symposia Series, and we're talking about the 60s and American Christianity. You can join us as well, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and we are coming to you live this Tuesday, the 18th of January. Okay, civil rights movement, what was it all about, and how did it affect the church that we see today?
You know, it's a rather coincidental. I happened to be in Selma, Alabama over the weekend.
Really?
And to retrace the steps, I flew out of Montgomery. So the trail that was followed by Dr. King in March 1965 and the folks moving from Selma over to Montgomery for voting rights for the African Americans who had been largely disestablished, it's really a powerful thing to see. That movement, African American voting rights, civil rights more generally speaking, really was a churchly movement. And that was bound up, tied up within the African-American experience as something that the church not only should do, but felt compelled it must do. So within that context, that was really what the African-American church did within the South. There's a nice book recently republished by Oxford University Press by Albert Rabiteau, who's a professor at Princeton, called Slave Religion, The Invisible Institution in the Antebellum South, and he makes a strong point that this has been part and parcel of the African-American religious experience from the beginning. He does imply in that book, too, that there's always been a linkage, as it were, to the more, how shall we say it, liberal tradition in the Northeast. And there's much to commend that that view. Some of the early abolitionists were tied up in the revival movements of the 1800s and saw the church's expression in basic ways being shaped by their advocacy on behalf of those who did not have certain rights. But that did go underground for quite some time, as they were dispossessed over the course of the late 19th and then into the 20th century. When this reemerges as a coherent movement in the 1950s and then through the 1960s, it has a powerful rhetoric that it's able to employ by showing that not only is this a historical movement, that we've had this amongst us for some time, but they also make a rather compelling case that that this is, at least in their own tradition, how the scriptures have been interpreted, a biblical movement. And that does then affect not only the older churches that had been affected by this, the African-American churches in the South, the classic theological liberal churches in the Northeast, but little by little it makes its way into the parlance and the life of the churches generally speaking, so that if you take a look at the Lutheran Witness of our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, by the mid-1960s, civil rights is a consistent theme, and it's highly emphasized even within our own, which at that point is largely a German or a German-American church.
I'm wondering, not about civil rights in particular, but about the activism that was found in the civil rights era in churches. Has it been carried too far? Would we have an American evangelicalism that views itself almost, in some cases, first and foremost as a political movement, if it were not for the civil rights movement and the ideas of the 60s that were brought into the church?
I guess the way I'm arguing here is that what you see in the 60s are the churches recapturing an earlier argument. And interestingly enough, there's a book that's recently been published by D.G. Hart called The Lost Soul of American Protestantism, where he makes a very intriguing argument, and I think a good argument, that we kind of miss the point when we talk about liberals and conservatives or liberals and evangelicals in this regard, because what they actually have are the same roots. They come out of the revivalist tradition of the early 19th century. They were vigorously activist in their attitude. And so then as they play that activism out in their unique ways, they're simply being consistent with their older tradition. The groups that don't quite fit in, the groups that are especially affected by the recapture of this tradition, are the older confessional churches that really hadn't participated in that up to this point. Which is all to say then, what you have, especially in the evangelical movement, is an assumption of activism that is part and parcel of their existence, that begins now in the wake of the civil rights movement in the 1960s to express it in intentionally political ways. Prior to this point, they kind of operated on the fringe, and this is what you did. But from this point forward, it becomes front and center, and this is what you do. So that Jerry Falwell, the Moral Majority, Pat Robertson and his run for the presidency in 1988, those kind of things don't seem strange to these folks, whereas if you pushed it back 80 years, they would have said, well, maybe you shouldn't be involved in that forum. The 60s enabled them to jump in with both feet.
The women's movement, and along with it, really for the sake of time, the sexual revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we see those movements of the 60s and beyond in the church today?
In regard to the women's movement, again, you have an older argument that crystallizes in the 60s, and that is, back in the 1800s, one of the main places for women to exercise authority and to provide leadership was in the churches. Many of the other forums were simply shut out to them, but places like the Sunday school, the leadership in the temperance movement and the like, were open, and they took advantage of those opportunities. So there was an assumption that women had a role to play, particularly in the church. As the 60s break out, and the rhetoric of freedom and liberty, absolute equality, as that kind of language becomes more and more pushed, more and more becomes more and more front and center in America's own vocabulary, women who within the evangelical tradition who had been used to exercising this authority now are even more greatly empowered by it, so that from this point, what had been previous to this time, perhaps unusual, things like women in ministry and the like. You did have women evangelists, and, you know, Amy Semple McPherson earlier in the 20th century and the like. From this point forward, that becomes not an anomaly. That becomes, in a lot of cases, the expectation.
So the average non-denominational evangelical, if there is such a thing, will, if you ask them the question, should women be pastors, might look at you like, why are you even asking this question? What are you talking about? Haven't they always been? Well, no. Well, I don't understand why you're even asking me this question.
Right, right, right. And that's, there you see, it's a building argument. But by the 60s, the church, in many ways, is not able to make a sustained argument against it any longer by saying, well, what do you turn to? A couple of Bible verses where it says, let a woman keep silence, and I do not allow a woman to have authority over men. But how do you interpret that? Where do you make that a normative statement against women in ministry? And not having, well, really defining ministry in a different way as a person who is able to preach and able to attract a crowd, the evangelicals see women able to preach and able to attract a crowd, and that's the end of the story.
Here's a softball with only about 1 minute, no more than a minute. Would we have the Episcopal Church USA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Church, considering gay marriage, the ordination of actively gays, were it not for the sexual revolution of the 60s?
I don't think so. I think that's bound right up with that. And the women's question is not entirely removed from that. The text that it is often appealed to, there's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, is initially used to argue for allowing for the ordination of women, but now is being used as the argument for allowing homosexual ordination. And if there's neither male nor female, then sexual orientation is no longer an issue in terms of denying a person ordination. You wouldn't have had that if you hadn't had the radical breakdown of cultural mores with the sexual revolution.
And what we're trying to do here, folks, in the course of this conversation with Dr. Larry Rast, is to make you more aware of the fact that whether you are a member of a liberal or a conservative, a denominational or a non-denominational church, your church has been radically affected by the radical 1960s in ways that you may not have considered before. We're going to talk about some more of those ways when we come back from this break. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 18th of January, from the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We're broadcasting live from the 2005 Symposia Series here. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Larry Rast is our guest. We're talking about the 60s in American Christianity. He's Associate Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Feel free to join us at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the second hour of the program, we'll discuss covenant theology, and I want to hear from our Calvinist listeners. We'll be talking about that with Professor Richard Muller. They're in the second hour of Issues Etc. Stay tuned. More with Dr. Larry Rast when we come back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
At the end of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus speaks the words, "Go, make disciples by baptizing and teaching." What did Jesus give the church to teach? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January is Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. Discourses in Matthew is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. Discourses in Matthew, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or go online to our website, issuesetc.org, and look under the What's New section for more information and a way to order the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church, by Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. David Scare.
Trusting relationships open the door for sharing news about Jesus Christ. This Global Minute lets you hear about India and how men and women get to tell others about their hope. In a busy city or crowded village, offering a room where curious Hindus or Muslims can walk in and read the Bible or Christian books has proven effective. India Evangelical Missions, or IEM, has several reading rooms so people can read more about Christ or learn what Christian authors have to say about the tough issues of life. IEM trains evangelists through a Bible college who minister in places where no one has ever heard about Jesus Christ. That's one way of building relationships and friendships in order to share Christ's love. But IEM also operates a children's home where orphans receive loving care. Pray for gospel breakthroughs in India. Ignite your prayers for India with a free brochure called To India with Love. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I'm old enough now that sleeping through the night is not automatic. Too much food and drink, worries, work, whatever, all those things can disturb my sleep. You probably know that miserable feeling, waking up and finding it's only the middle of the night. Hello, Night is Herbert Brokering's book about his experience with sleepless nights. He writes, through the years, illness and major surgery have made my night special. Night is a quiet time for self-examination, for a close look at a big thought, a large worry, a great plan, a vision. Few interruptions disturb night thoughts. I meet God with worry or anger or stress or suspense. My night thoughts are prayers. Psalm 4 says, when you are on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. I will lie down and sleep in peace, says a psalmist, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. The psalmist in Psalm 139 asks a probing question. Sleep-filled or sleepless nights, he says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting.
On the next Focus on the Family.
I did not dare cry because if I did, my eyes would get wet and my nose would run. And it's bad enough being a quad. You don't want to be a messy quad.
Johnny Erickson Tata shares her struggles with God following her tragic accident and how she handled the pain when the healing didn't come. Don't miss this moving edition of Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Well, folks, you might think that your church somehow escaped the onslaught of the 60s, like a ark floating high above the flood, safe and sound, but it's not true. No matter what church, kind of church you attend, the 1960s have influenced what you hear preached, how you worship, how you think, what you believe as well. And that's part of our task here in this first hour of Issues Etc. with Dr. Larry Rast. Just a reminder, in the second hour, we'll be talking with Professor Richard Muller about covenant theology. He's professor of systematic theology at Concordia Theological Seminary here in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He was a former student at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, one of the largest and most influential Calvinist seminaries in the United States. We'll be talking about that in the second hour of the program today. We're broadcasting live from the 2005 Symposia Series at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Associate Professor of Historical Theology here at Concordia, Dr. Larry Rast, is our guest. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk about widespread historical amnesia. I've noted that this is prevalent in American Christianity. History is either irrelevant or it is a matter of almost complete ignorance. Is this a result in some way of the influence of the 60s in some part?
I think it is. The particular intensity that we see it today, you know, this is the emerging theme of my remarks here, is that it's not something necessarily new. It's almost an intensification of pre-existing conditions that you see in the 60s. For example, you look back at the founding of our nation and this idea of a new order for the ages, a novus ordo seculorum, and a secular one at that. The founders of our country and people in the early national period knew they were doing something very new. And a lot of times they'd say very intentionally, we're casting off the tyranny of the past. But in the 60s, you start to see this in new and even more intense ways. I mean, anything that even smacks of having a history, anything that has a deeper past, is seen as part of the establishment. And the establishment simply exists to oppress. So, well, what's the job of the church? To come and speak of liberty and freedom for those who are in bondage. The church's job then must be to cast off the past and the oppressive past in any way, shape, or form, whether that's a doctrinal oppression, whether it's a practical oppression. But we need to cast that off. So we need to be sensitive, people were saying in the 60s, to new circumstances, new opportunities, and anything that would get in the way of our progressing, moving on, and providing that freedom and liberty in the most powerful ways, we've got to get rid of.
Is the non-denominational movement, which I'm hard-pressed to think of a genuinely non-denominational church prior to about 1950, is that a result also of this kind of anti-authoritarianism of the 60s?
I think you made a good connection there, Todd. The denominations themselves are seen as problematic. Not surprisingly, by the time you get to the 1950s, some of the older denominations that burst onto the scene in the 1800s have bureaucratized, they've grown and have significant as institutions. They've they own property, they have boards, they have mission boards that are reaching out around the world, and that takes a lot of structure just to keep it operating. And folks say, well, that structure, that's just one more way of getting in the way of things. The denomination itself, therefore, is existing simply to serve the denomination. Let's cast it off. Let's be not bound to some denomination. Let's simply be bound to the scriptures themselves. And there's this notion that what you called historical amnesia, in some cases, it's not that the past is irrelevant, and it's not that folks are ignorant of it. There is an intentional casting off and saying, we don't want that organized church, whether it's the church of the 1800s, the 1500s, the 500s, or anything except the New Testament church, and this idea that we can create, recreate, in our own setting, by our own actions, the New Testament church. That trumps everything.
It's not that different. And this was actually seen in the Jesus people, in the Jesus movement. It's not that different from kind of the hippie mentality that said, let's go to a commune, we will recreate society, human civilization on a small scale, right here on our little organic farm, and it will be bliss.
And it the notion is you withdraw from society in order to save society. You recreate it in at small scale. And the attractiveness of the community there, where you're getting back to the early book of Acts, where they had all things in common, and this kind of thing. We'll recreate that within our own small context, and as people see that, they'll be drawn to it. We'll recreate it in other communities, and little by little, we'll be able to act as a leaven in the world to change it by means of that.
Let's talk about the Vietnam War. What impact has that had in the church today?
The Vietnam War, well, for one thing, the difficulty with which the United States prosecuted that war and the results of it were really, in a lot of ways, devastating to our cultural identity. And the pictures in the early 70s of evacuating the embassy in South Vietnam and Saigon and the like, just devastating to our national psyche. That in every war before, we always had God on our side. We were in the righteous position. Whether it was the Revolution and we were battling the Antichrist George III, or you do get a variety of opinions when you talk about the war between the states, or the Civil War, or whatever you want to name it. where both sides thought they had God on their side. But in the end, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, and it was to set people free. We always had this notion that we were on the right side and that God blessed our efforts and brought them success. Now, in the Vietnam War, suddenly we're entrenched in a difficult situation. The justice of our actions began to be questioned by very many people, and the end result was we lost. Well, what could that be other than God's clear statement that this was not a just war? And those churches then that had been involved in the carrying out of this war, that had supported the effort, that had spoken well of the government, that had supported President Johnson and then President Nixon in carrying this thing out, were seen as utterly suspect. They're simply arms of the establishment, once again. And in this case, the churches were very much active in oppressing a people that didn't want to be oppressed, the Vietnamese people. And in the end, God withdrew himself, as it were, from the nation and from those churches that were involved in this unjust activity. It had a powerful effect.
Has there been a backlash in popular American evangelicalism today, whereas many of the churches that turned out to be mainline liberalism in the 60s were out on the forefront saying Vietnam's a bad idea and we shouldn't be doing it? Well, now, in popular American evangelicalism, they're going to say, we're going to be for any war, every war, whatever, or because we don't want to be like those liberals.
Right.
Without even really asking the question of the moral ambiguity or the moral right and wrong.
Right. It's kind of two sides of the same coin or two extremes of the same point. You end up with, on the one hand, a critical, in the 60s, this critical engagement saying, the church can't do anything right when it comes to this because it's become so beholden to the state. To the other side now being, we have to support the state at every point and not allow any kind of negativism to creep into it. Our unique role as church is to pray for the government, and if we're faithful and we pray well and we carry out our responsibilities as God has given them to us, then we'll see our efforts crowned once again with success and with victory. It's an attitude that expresses it remarkably. Though you have very different philosophical commitments, the attitude is quite often more or less the same.
There was a technological explosion, unrivaled except for probably the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. in the 1960s, culminating symbolically with us putting our first American on the moon.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether or not that has fed into the love affair that modern American Christians have with technology. We've got our screens, we've got our computers, we've got our PowerPoint, we've got our electronic instruments. If the technology comes along, we immediately say, this must be good, and we must find a way to use it.
Right. Technology. How can you question technology?
It put a man on the moon.
Exactly. It's conquered almost every barrier. We still struggle with some, but we have this great optimism in and among ourselves that, we'll be able to overcome that. And, maybe you say, I may not see it in my lifetime, but I'm pretty confident that, if my kids or my grandkids' lifetime, they're going to be able to enjoy all the more fruits of these efforts in this notion. Good. I mean, it really is a powerful American attitude, and it's one that the church has largely adopted, lock, stock, and barrel, that technology is the answer. And not to be technologically adept, to eschew technology shows one as that most horrible of things in post-60s America, somebody stuck in the past. Somebody, who is a dinosaur, somebody who's irrelevant. And boy, those are the worst words you can apply to anybody in America, that they're tied to the past, that they're not with the times, and that above all that makes them meaningless.
What about, you said you had wanted to talk about the emergence of alternative religions, in particular kind of the new phenomenon of the celebrity religion, the Beatles go off to see the Mahesh. I can't even pronounce his name anymore. It used to be on the tip of my tongue when we were living closer to the 60s. But they go off with many other luminaries from Hollywood and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we're learning about religions that have existed for thousands of years that we didn't know were there.
Yeah. It's not that the West didn't know about these religions. When transportation routes open up in the 16 and 1700s and the colonializing efforts begin, they go out and they bump into these folks and they see them. But there's even in the period of rationalism, Christians have this rather pronounced notion of being something better. If very frankly, Western Europeans see themselves as being more advanced than these other groups. Even one of the fathers of classic theological liberalism, Friedrich Schleiermacher, sees Christianity as the pinnacle of religions. He doesn't discount the other religions. He says they're good insofar as they've developed, but we Christians have developed beyond that. What happens in the 60s is that the pluralism implicit in the founding of America finally comes home to roost. And that is this notion that all are created equal. There is freedom and liberty and equality available to all. Really plays itself out in the most powerful way. And that is to say, no longer can you make that unique claim for Christianity, or people become increasingly unwilling to make that unique claim for Christianity, that it is the way, you know, Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. Instead, you end up with people beginning to dabble in other religions that, you know, for a variety of reasons, maybe they're philosophically exotic, and maybe in some people's minds they just work better, the old pragmatism argument. When I was a kid, I was a big fan of the guitarist of the rock band The Who, mm-hmm. Peter Townsend.
Oh yeah,
and he had this life-changing experience when he was a young man in the '60s, where he became aware of this Indian, you can't call him a guru, but spiritual master named Meher Baba. And he became a Baba lover, as they call them. And he followed Baba, and that influenced his music. So I'm listening to this music as a kid, and I'm learning all about Meher Baba. And in fact, a lot of us learned an awful lot about Meher Baba, although we probably didn't know it in 1988 when that song came out, "Don't Worry, Be Happy."
Oh yeah,
that was Baba. That was his main saying. And here you know, we're all singing do 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 and doing this Baba chant for crying out loud. Well, it's a happy little song and a fun little song. Without knowing the religious character of this thing, we just kind of popped right into it. So it's really quite striking. But these pop culture figures really began to awaken people's interest to alternative religions, and it almost seemed there was a competition amongst them to see who could come up with the most exotic new religion to pursue. It's quite a time.
We're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 18th of January, broadcasting live from the 2005 Symposia Series here at Concordia Theological Seminary. Dr. Larry Rast is our guest. We're talking about the 60s in American Christianity. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727 are our phone numbers. The death of God, I wouldn't call it so much a movement, because it was kind of just a pronouncement. God is dead. You could see it everywhere. Most people probably did not realize what it was, or the long roots that statement had that finally was set out in public in the 60s. Talk about that.
Yeah, in the late 1800s, you already had philosophers who were making the pronouncement that the concept of God was no longer a meaningful concept for people. It didn't, philosophically, it wasn't necessary, and in fact, it truncated human capability, that it kept you from becoming the Übermensch, the Superman that was inherent within you. And in fact, the only real purpose of religion from the perspective of many of these folks was that it was used by priests, as they like to call them, to control others and to empower themselves. Well, when that sort of language was used in the late 1800s, it was pretty radical, and many people weren't ready to go that far. They wanted to affirm some kind of a God. But in the 1960s, you begin to have people who step out a little bit. Harvey Cox with The Secular City saying, you know, God is a meaningful topic. It simply doesn't function anymore. Or Bishop Pike in the Episcopal Church saying, there is no God, and I don't need God to be an Episcopal bishop. The fact that people are increasingly able to make such statements, not, you know, this isn't the older 1800 stuff that, oh, Jesus is a man, he's not God. This is, there is no God at all. But that is seen not as a problematic statement, but in fact a purely natural statement for a theologian and bishop to make. And then the church is oftentimes incapable of addressing it. Shows you that this notion of freedom of speech, you know, radicalism in its most pronounced forms, has simply run amok.
Do you think that the American church, the Main Street American church, that has to some degree bought into the idea that truth is relative, somewhat relative, maybe they won't go the whole way, and that moral truth might be relative, biblical truth is certainly relative, and maybe the God of the Jew and the Muslim is just as good as the God of the Christian. This is, you can find this in most churches, in a lot of churches. Do you think they realize that at the root of that relativism is this nihilism that would eventually pronounce God dead?
I think for the average pastor or average person who's in that church and hearing this, no, they probably don't think that. It's just become part of the air that they breathe and the water that they drink. How do you make that exclusive claim for Christianity anymore becomes the real problem that the churches start to face. And those churches that do make those exclusivistic kind of claims become, in many cases, the enemy. So that, a few years back, I think it was in St. Louis, as a matter of fact, there was a Baptist who made the pronouncement that, Christianity was the one true religion, and that, as difficult as it was to say this, Islam was not. And it was not a legitimate religion. Well, the response from within the church, meaning mainline denominationalism, and was abject horror. How could a person say such a thing? So there is a variety of opinion then, obviously, within the church. But on other points, you still see that seed of uncertainty, that seed of relativism, even within some of the more conservative churches. Where before they were willing to say with great vigor and great clarity, this is most certainly true, well, the things about which they're willing to say that have decreased. This is most certainly true, but we're not so sure about that anymore.
The list is getting shorter.
It's getting shorter, yeah.
All right, a couple quick things as our time goes short. Vatican II, some people might say, oh, that only had an effect on Roman Catholics, and it was a momentous effect, but it only affected Roman Catholics. Has it affected American Christianity in general?
It has, generally speaking. The basic notion, with John the 23rd, when he comes to the papal throne, he says, I want to open up the windows of the church and let some fresh air in. Well, that's just another way of saying the older dogma has become stale. It's not lively. It doesn't give life. It's something that restricts us rather than frees us. And he said, let's run off on new channel. Let's let the Spirit be the Spirit. And Vatican II, in that respect, really does cut some new swaths, some radical new swaths. I remember as a little kid, we were in Kansas City for a time, when one of my friends, when his parish went from using the Latin Mass to the vernacular Mass, he came home that day from church and he said, well, we don't have church anymore. He'd kind of been cut loose from everything he knew, and simply hearing the priest say, use English in the Mass, this kid was just adrift from that point. But others said, no, this is the way we have to go. If we don't do this, we can't be relevant. Well, there's one of your principles at work in the 60s once again.
What about American civil religion? Someone has argued on this program, and I don't remember who it was right off the top of my head, that up until probably the mid-20th century, maybe not that far, American civil religion was basically Calvinist Protestantism. With the edges knocked off, but still, you could recognize it. Since the 60s, this guest said, it has been increasingly more and more Buddhist. That American civil religion, in popular expression, as a religious public religious expression that serves the interests of the state first and foremost, is really Buddhism nowadays. Is that a result of the 60s, too?
It would be. I'm thinking of one historian in particular named Sidney Ahlstrom, wrote a massive book on the history of Christianity in America and argued that Puritanism characterized American religion until the 60s. And when the 60s came along, that Puritanism went away. By Puritanism, he meant an evangelical Calvinism. And that collapsed. And now he didn't have anything to put in its place when he wrote the book in 1972. Instead, he noted a vague spirituality that was increasingly characterizing people. Well, I think you probably could make the argument that that would be kind of a Buddhist orientation, that you're embraced in the divine somehow or another, and it's if you're a spiritual person, that's a good thing. But whatever character that spirituality might take.
Finally, I think I can make a pretty sound argument that the major leadership of American Christianity, wherever you find it nowadays, are probably children of the 60s. They were either born then, like you and I were, or they had their formative years during the 60s. How has, in a nutshell, the church changed since the 1960s under this new leadership? You've got about a minute and a half,
more. That's a great question. And the basic couple of points that I would make is, one is this notion of historical amnesia, that you may know your story, you may be there's a certain nostalgia about knowing a portion of your story, but whether it actually informs what you do or not, or whether you have a meaningful relationship with your past, it's largely an indifferent matter. So that's one point. Secondly, there is this idea of radical equality and freedom and liberty informing all things, and that's an outgrowth of what I was saying before. That is to say, if you find expressions in your church doctrinally, practically, that are not satisfying to you, then you change them. That's just what we do here in America, and we have the freedom, we have the right, we have the authority to do that as we see fit. So on your press, and simply take it in whatever direction the will of the people may be, and however you determine that will of the people in your particular tradition, that's what you do. But this notion of what seems to begin to be lost is this basic point of there being an objective truth, a confession that ties you not with just your present time and your present circumstances, but that you become part of the church as church. That is, you're drawn together by the Holy Spirit to speak the unchanging truth that God reveals in His Word across time, whether it's with the church of the first century, whether it's with St. Augustine, whether it's with Martin Luther, 19th century confessors as well. This idea that the church is not an atomized group of self-willed, collected people, but rather is that body that the Holy Spirit has called, gathered, enlightened, and sanctified through His Word, and made them His own.
Dr. Larry Rast is Associate Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where we're broadcasting live from the 2005 Symposia Series. Larry, thank you again for being our guest.
My pleasure, Todd. Thanks so much.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking to Professor Richard Muller, Professor of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary here in Fort Wayne. He was a former student at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, one of the most influential Calvinist seminaries, Presbyterian seminaries in the United States. We're going to talk about one of the pillars of Calvinist theology that I think is often overlooked, and that is covenant theology. What is it? It sounds good. It sounds very biblical. We'll find out what it is when we come back from this break. And then in the third hour of the program, as we broadcast from the symposia here at Concordia Theological Seminary, live this Tuesday on the 18th of January, we're going to be talking about that ELCA, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America document that was issued last week on human sexuality. What did it have to say, and what lies ahead for the largest of the Lutheran church bodies in the United States? We'll be right back after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.